Accession number 9168, rule number 19.
Mr. Anat, reel 19.
Well, it got to 1926, I think it was, and I was still up the shore on the frontier, and I was detailed to attend an advanced driving course at the Royal Tank Course School at Armanagha, the same place as I was before, in the year before. And when I got there, you get a bit of a test. You go in front of a panel of officers and they ask you all sorts of questions about the makeup of the IC engine, and you have to explain what a differential is and a carburetor and all that. And then if they think you've got a smattering of what they're trying to teach you, they accept you and you carry on. And I was 4 months there on this course, so it's quite a long time. And during the time I was there, I had to take on the job of instructor myself because of sickness with the instructors. There was two of them absent, so they allocated me a class, and I had to carry on as if I was the instructor instead of the pupil. And anyway, they taught you everything about driving and the maintenance of the IC engine, and all the parts. And nearly every day, the first thing you did was, every other day, you go into a classroom, and there's charts there set up on a blackboard, and the instructor tells you all about all the parts of an IC engine, and you have to learn all these parts and make sketches yourself and make notes. And then perhaps in the afternoon you'd go out and you'd do 2 or 3 hours driving in an armoured vehicle. Well, the vehicles they had in this part of the India were Crossley armoured cars, and they were totally different to our old Rolls-Royce cars that we used to have up in Peshawar. They were a single turret, the same as our armoured cars, but they were all enclosed. The whole lot was all armoured, right the way down to the base of the wheels. And the turret was much more, much thicker than the old Rolls-Royce turrets. And the actual guns were also armoured. So each one of the Vickers guns, instead of weighing 28 pounds like ours did, they weighed 56 pounds. Because all the casing on the gun was armoured, and they had ball mountings on in the turret. There was two of these, and they stuck out at angles from the front, although the turret could be revolved, and the guns were pushed into these ball mountings, and so you had complete all-round protection. Anyway, apart from that, we used to take these cars out and, as I say, do 2 or 3 hours driving, take it in turns, and it'd probably be about 20 minutes or 25 minutes each, and then after a bit you'd stop, and the instructor would ask you a few questions and get you to explain something that he thought you hadn't quite understood, and eventually, after quite a bit, you began to realise that you, when you first came there, you knew very little about IC engines and cars, but by the time the course was over, you knew quite a lot about them. Anyway, one of the rather frightening things about this course was the fact that during the end of the course, they take you up into the hills, well, foothills of what was the Western Ghats then, across the western side of India, and quite a few thousand feet these hills used to rise up and take you up during the day. And when you got to about a place about 3,000 feet drop, the road got about 3,000 feet over a valley, they'd halt the column, and then the instructor would say, right, everybody out, and you'd, there's three or well, four or five of you in the, on the squad and drop out of the car, and you take it in turns to get in the driver's seat and reverse the car on this high road over this 3,000 feet drop and turn it round the other way. And the reason for that is because the danger of somebody doing something wrong. If the car went over, the whole lot would go over with it. But if there's any one of you, it was just unfortunate. And the instructor used to step on the running board at the side, hold on to a bar, and instruct you. And I know when I got in there, he said, right, advance, that's you have to go forward. And the seats in those armoured cars, the same as there was in the Rolls, you sat on the floor on a cushion. So you laid back on a sling, which went round underneath your arms and round your shoulders, and that was the way you sat. And all you could see was the sky when you sat down, when you're looking over the top of this drop. And he'd say, right, advance, and you hadn't got a clue where you were going. You simply went on very, put it in gear and went on very steady, and ready to put a brake on as soon as he told you to. Anyway, alongside the edge of this drop was large, well, fairly large boulders, about 2 foot thick, strewn along the edge, so that even if you'd got near the edge, one of your wheels would have hit one of these boulders, and that would tell you that you were right near the edge. Anyway, you had to go forward so many yards, or so many feet, because it wasn't really wide, and then you'd have to reverse back a couple of times and eventually turn the car around. Rather frightening experience, but it's one of those things that you had to undergo on this course. Another one was near the end of the course. You'd go out on a night duty. And when it got dark, you'd set off and we had your lights on, but when you got to this large area that was allocated for this particular night driving, by the way, we never took armoured cars. We used to take lorries or trucks, and we used to call them in those days, about 30 underweight truck, and you'd pile into there each squad. And one of the officer instructors would be standing on the back, and he'd give you orders, and whatever orders he gave you, you had to obey. And then first thing he used to say was, right, lights out, and you switch all your lights out, and you can see anything at all. You're absolutely in total darkness, and they say, right, advance, and you put the clutch in and go on to this, right, speed up 10 miles an hour, and you change it to top gear, and you're going about 25 or 30 miles an hour. You haven't got a clue where you're going. You couldn't see anything at all. And all you could do was feel the bumps underneath the wheels as you went over parts of rocky ground. And that was a test of sort of confidence, because you had to be confident that the officer was telling you what to do in the right direction. Everybody had a go at that, and rather frightening at the time, but after you'd done it a couple of times, you sort of got used to it, because when we went over the ground some days later, we could see that there was hardly any danger. It was miles of ordinary flat level plain, so you wouldn't have come to it any harm in any case. Anyway, I got over that. Oh, at the end of the course, another part of it was when you had to pass out, each squad was given a lorry, which was in a garage, all stripped down. The only thing that was constant about it was the fact that it had a chassis and a body, but there was no engine there. The engine was on a bench, or stripped right down, all parts, and you were given a week, each squad, and you had to assemble this this engine, bolt it onto the chassis, put all the parts in place, and get it running so that under its own steam, it'd come out of the garage a full lorry length under its own steam, and that's when he passed. I know it was rather all sorts of the nuts and bolts and washers and springs and things that we fore on his bench was always like a puzzle. Eventually we managed with the aid of sketches and all that we'd done to put all the parts back and put the valves in and get it all set, and filled up the tank with petrol. And then I remember our engine, we got everything going. We, in those days, you had to start the engine with a starting handle. You ran on the front of the radiator. We swung that up and everything seems to be working fine, but we still had a couple of dozen bolts and nuts and washers and things laying on the bench. But anyway, it seemed to work, so we filled up the tank and started up, and eventually one of the chaps got in the driving seat and it drove it out, and we got past. But where these other spare bits and pieces went, we never knew after that. But that was one of the tests we had. Well, when I got back to, I found that the unit had moved to Lahore. That's much lower south towards Delhi, away from the frontier. And I don't know if I mentioned it, but the buildings. Did I mention it before? Well, when we got to Lahore, as the unit had moved while I was on this course, I was rather surprised to find this new cantonment was really modernised. There was no barracks like there was up in Peshawar. It was all modern brick-built buildings with ordinary walls, the same as an English house would be, because we were away from the earthquake zone. And it wasn't necessary to build houses the same as they were up in Peshawar. And these were very modernised, and some of them were two-storied, and especially the canteen block. And there was fans installed instead of the old punkers. And up-to-date toilet, washing facilities, and every convenience properly modernised. Different camp altogether. And whilst I was there, we used to go on all sorts of stunts with these armoured cars, because as they were very mobile, we could get about and do quite a lot of mileage that ordinary toots wouldn't have been able to do. I know I went out one day with my OC, and we had two armoured cars and a motorbike. We went to call on a unit about 200 miles away. And when we got there, just in time for lunch, we had lunch, or tiffin, as it was called, and then we'd have to set back. And I know the officer said, we started off and went back, and we went to within about 60 miles of our camp, our barracks, and he said, well, we dismounted and had a bit of confidence. He said, well, look, we got 60 miles to go, and I want to be back by 4 o'clock, and it's now 3. So he said, we'll have to get moving. So he said, these cars can easily do 60 miles an hour. So he said, I'll lead and keep dust distance. Well, dust distance in those days meant that you had to keep, let the car in front of you get away, so that by the time you got away, you'd have to let the dust settle. Because in most of the days out in India, the dry season, you get this dust rising, the least little movement, even people walking raises a cloud of dust. But you can just imagine what a car would raise racing along at 60 miles an hour. Anyway, you wait until the dust had settled, and I got in the car with my crew, and I had a young driver on there who only just come out from England, and I said, right, I'll advance and speed up. And I wasn't satisfied with the speed we were going, because I looked at my watch and found that we were losing we'd never get there in time at all. So I said, right, come out of there. And I got in the driving seat and put my foot down and started speeding up to recapture a little time we'd lost. And we got to a point where there was an avenue of trees and we were racing along. And as I say, these roads were only wide enough for one vehicle. And I saw a line of bullocks, water buffalo, coming from one side of the road to the other. And I didn't slacken speed at all, because I more or less got an idea that I could. There was a gap in between the leading cattle and the others that was following. But anyway, I judged it so that I could just hit this gap before the next herd of cattle had come across. Plenty of room, really. But the last one of the first herd that was crossing, it didn't do what I wanted it to do. He simply stopped in the middle of the road and looked up, because by that time I was doing at 60 miles an hour. I slowed down as much as I could, put my brakes on, and the co-driver side of me pulled the armour doors too. But we hit this buffalo mid-riff on, and I felt the car go up in the air and slither across several yards across the right-hand side of the road onto the field at the side, and then come to a halt. And then I smelt burning flesh and sort of fumes coming from underneath. Anyway, we all scrambled out, and I made sure everybody was all right and there was nobody hurt, but it was a bit shaken. And then when I had a look round, I found that the armoured car was resting on the ribs of this water buffalo, with the engine up in the air and the back part just touching the ground. And I knew that I'd got to get this. There was no other vehicle in the vicinity at all. I've got to get this vehicle back somehow. And it was quite a problem. But anyway, there was one or two natives gathered round, and I, with my pidgin Hindustani, I asked them to go to the village and bring out the chief or the head, one of the village. And eventually some elderly man came out, and I managed to persuade him that what I wanted was some help from the villagers to try and get this bullock out from underneath the armoured car. So what I done was I got my crew to jack up the front of the vehicle as best they could, and the natives brought bricks to pack up underneath the chassis, until eventually we got the wheels and the chassis clear of the beast. But then we had a job of dragging the beast out. So we got the tow rope round his horns, and I asked the villagers to bring as many ropes as they could, and we got this all tied up. And I organised the villagers into a line pulling on these ropes when I gave them the signal, and our chaps were helping with their crowbars, and eventually we dragged this beast out from underneath the armoured car, and then let the jacks off and dropped it down. And I tested the engine, and the engine was still running, and I tested the steering wheel, and you could still steer a bit, but although the wheels looked a bit queer, the one wheel seemed to be about 6 inches rear from the back of the other wheel. There was no alignment at all. Anyway, we got it on the road, and we found that we got a fractured petrol pump, a petrol pipe leading from the tank to the engine. So always carried a gallon can of petrol. So I got one of the chaps to lay on the running board, which is a running board run alongside the armoured car, with this petrol can, and he was with a funnel pouring it into the carburettor so that we could get the juice to run back. And eventually we arrived back about 9 o'clock at night, and he reported to the guard room, and the guard commander said, "You got to report to the OC tomorrow morning." And we put the armoured car away and dispersed the crew, and eventually the next morning I had to go up in front of the OC And well, the sergeant major said to me, "You're on a charge, damaging the military vehicle and all that sort of thing, and contrary to the military law in those days." Anyway, I was on two or three charges, and eventually we had a major who was standing in because our captain was away on leave, and he gave me a lecture and said, "You're severely reprimanded, and your trade pay is going to be stopped for 6 months." And that was my little episode with that business. Well, during 1926, I remember we had, which we used to always go on manoeuvres once or twice every year with mixed forces. On this particular one, 1926, we went over the River Indus on a place called Attock Bridge. It was a huge steel structure, very much like the Forth Bridge, built by the British years before. And we had British artillery, cavalry, and Indian troops. I remember it was just at the start of the monsoon season, and it became very dull the first day. And in the second, on the first night, we encamped on some high ground, and in the night it poured a rain. Anyway, we've been on this manoeuvres all day, and I had a driver who was an old soldier who was in the First World War and had been at Mons. He very used to the army and all that. And anyway, he erected we had large tarpaulins that used to cover the whole armoured car, and we got two cars together, back to back, two armoured cars together, and strung these tarpaulins in such a way that they covered the ground behind the cars, and with the aid of a couple of poles, put the other sheet down so that we could put our ground sheets and blankets down and rest on them, and pull the bottom part up over our feet. And this old soldier, he erected this business, and it was quite satisfactory. Although it poured a rain all night, we was as dry as anything in our blankets. We couldn't move next day because of the mud, and we had to stop there several days. Very boring existence. But eventually we got back and got off back to our cantonment. But these manoeuvres were carried out with great precision. Another I remember is I was on reconnaissance on one of these manoeuvres, and I was supposed to contact the enemy. It was supposed to be at a certain distance. And I took an old country lane. There weren't no metalled roads in these villages and all that. And what they used to do was over a stream, they'd make a sort of humpback bridge that was stuck up in the middle so that to take the weight. That because our armoured cars were such that the sump of the engine was rather low, so that what happened was as we went over this humpback bridge, the sump caught the top of the hump of the bridge and tore off the bottom part of the sump and the drainage cock, so that all the oil seeped away and we were stranded. So anyway, I sent the motorcycle dispatch rider back, telling them what had happened and asking them to send a spare part. In the meantime, the opposition, who is supposed to be the enemy, are closed round, and we're all supposed to be either annihilated or taken prisoner, according to the referees. The referees used to go about there with had a white armband on, so that you could denote them from the rest of the troops. And the officer came up and said, "Right, you're either all dead or captured." That was that was one of the aspects we used to go through. Anyway, I eventually got I got the sump fixed up, and we got back to our own unit.
Did you go into the hills in the hot seasons?
Did you go where?
Into the hills in the hot seasons.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, and it was 1926 again, a very eventful year apparently. We went up to, not the Murray Hills this time, we went up to another section of foothills. As we were in Lahore, we were quite south of where we were before, called Dalhousie. This was a much more sophisticated and apparently older hill station than the other one we'd been on. And we were able to drive all the way up in our cars, although normally on most of these hill stations you had to walk because the roads weren't suitable for especially armoured cars, but we were able to drive up there all right on this but this particular time. Well, whilst I was up at Dalhousie, we were in stone-built bungalows, and each one of the bungalows housed about 20 men on either side, the same as an ordinary barrack room with their beds facing the centre aisle, and had a large fireplace in the centre of one wall where wood logs were burned because it used to get very cold up there even in summertime. And this was at the end of the season, so it was getting very cold. But anyway, one of the things about it was the fact that at this particular part of the country, there was some black panthers roaming around in the hills at that time, in that particular area around Dalhousie. And sometimes on overnight time, when all our lights were out and we were safely in, the bungalow was built so that the back of our bungalow, the ground rose over actually the height of the roof. So sometimes we'd wake up in the night and look out of the window from that side and see a pair of eyes glaring at us and hear a growl, and we knew that this was one of these black panthers that were prowling around the outside of the bungalow.